The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
If you got the email, we included a quote from David Foster Wallace. David Foster Wallace is one of these elite literary guys. I do not claim to have read any of his novels. I've read some of his essays. My daughter has read some of his novels, but they're highly complicated. He's a tragic man, an absolute genius, committed suicide in a way that was not unexpected, sadly. He was sort of dealing with shocking depression for some time. But David Foster Wallace has got this very insightful quote. There are a number of quotes like this written by people who aren't Christians, but he says this. Here's something that's weird but true, that in the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There is no such thing as not worshipping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And the compelling reason, maybe, for choosing some of the sorts of gods or spiritual types of things to worship, be it JC or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some inviolable set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else that you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if that is where you tap real meaning in your life, then you will never have enough. You will never feel that you have enough, and that's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, you will always feel ugly. And when time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before you finally die. On one level, we all know this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, epigrams, parables, and the skeleton of nearly every great story. The whole trick is to keep this truth up front and in daily consciousness. So that's a long quote. But David Foster Wallace, and by the way, if you play tennis, you might like to read his essay on tennis. I've never been able to watch tennis in the same way. He was quite a good tennis player. And just the way he describes what Roger Federer does was quite, it just opens your eyes, which is the sort of thing that Foster Wallace does. So this business, this assertion that all of us worship, and the question is simply what you worship. And perhaps the most dangerous worship of all is the unconscious worship, where there is a thing that functions as your God, but you're not even aware of it. Paul Tillich writes this, that your God is your supreme concern. Your God is your supreme concern. For most of us, it boils down, once we get down through some of the illusions, to ourselves. We are our great concern. I think you see that when you meet a person who thought that their prime concern was their family, but has done something which clearly was hostile to their family's well-being, particularly they've formed a relationship with someone other than their husband or their wife. And they actually are a chance of discovering that they thought their family was their prime concern, but actually it wasn't. It was their prime concern in as much as it was an extension of themselves. The word my was crucial. So this business of worship, it's not a thing that we talk about much. I think in our culture we tend to talk more about spirituality. Our culture, you'll meet, and you may be the sort of person who understandably says, look, I've got no interest in religion, but I'm interested in spirituality. And I think the reason why our culture speaks of spirituality is it fits in with our culture. That is, it's a part of me. It's an interest of mine. It's a development or an enhancement of my own happiness. So we're happy to talk about spirituality, where Jesus and the apostles and the prophets speak about worship. Worship which helpfully has a context, or has the sense is that there is something outside of yourself which you are focusing or revolving around. And the woman raises the question of worship in her conversation with Jesus. They've been talking about water, that which satisfies. The lady gets to the point of saying, I need it, I want it. Jesus has this strange conversation which is also about water when he talks to her about her past hard, sad, broken relationships with so many men. At the moment she's living with a guy that she can't get to marry him. And so she's had a lot of hurt, this lady. And I think Jesus is still talking about water, where she's been drinking or trying to drink. And the movement to worship is really not unrelated. The woman asks what is a classic question for her day, and that is the argument that's going on between Jesus' people and her people. You remember she raised the question of, how can you, a Jew, talk to me, a Samaritan? And then she asks this question. She says, let me get it here. That's what I meant to bring up. She says, our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you people say that Jerusalem is the place where we should worship. So she turns to the question of worship. Almost certainly, Gerizim is right next to them. So she's come to the conclusion Jesus is a prophet. She probably didn't expect to meet a Jewish prophet. If God was going to send a spokesman, surely he would send them through the Samaritans, who she was convinced were the right guys. But she's realized this guy is a prophet, so she asks him the question about how should we worship? There was an ongoing fight. The Samaritans had a temple on Mount Gerizim. They had good reason to think Mount Gerizim might be the sacred mountain. It was probably the mountain where Abraham offered the first sacrifice when he came into Palestine, or into the Promised Land before he got it. It was the mountain which when the Israelites entered into the Promised Land, they stood and read the great blessings of God. It's only later on in the Bible that God identifies Jerusalem, and that was in the books that they chose not to read. So that there was a legitimate reason for them to think Gerizim was the place to worship, whereas the Jews had legitimate reason to think Jerusalem. She asks Jesus, where should we worship? Now, it'd be silly not to try and do some sort of a definition of what worship is. I like definitions. If someone's going to talk to me about something, I like to know what we're talking about. The word translated here as worship, the Greek word, actually, most scholars think it comes from the word to kiss. And in some of the Egyptian reliefs, we can see etchings, I suppose, what do you call them? Carvings of people worshipping, and they're throwing a kiss to the gods. They're doing this. And this is where the word proskuneo, the word worship, comes from. It is to kiss. It is to kiss the hand. It is to kiss the ground. It is a word of affection and devotion. So yesterday, I worshipped my mother. That is, I went, and a number of levels I did, using the word technically, but I blew her a kiss as I left. I think, you know, maybe the last time I get to see her. And that's what the word means. It means to honour someone. It becomes the word worship, to regard someone with great respect, even extravagant respect. Now, in English, as many of you will know, the word worship is an abbreviation of worship. It comes quite simply from the worship of someone. And I was helped by Tim Keller, who says, imagine this. Imagine that some aunt gives you a necklace. And it's bits of gold-looking stuff and a few sparkly stones. You just chuck it into your top drawer. You leave it there for a couple of years. And then one time a friend who's a jeweller happens to be there, and somehow or other they get to see it. And they get all excited, and they begin to look at it. And they turn to you and say, do you know what this is? Oh, yeah, it's some piece of circus jewellery I got. No. He said, this is made by an 18th century Russian jeweller, gives you the name, who was famous for making pieces for the royal households of Paris, etc., etc. This is, and he talks about it, and he says, look at this, look at this particular work around this particular gem. This is a, this is a real emerald here, and this is a real diamond, and you're getting interested. But you just look at the work, look at the way that he's, and he says, there's a jeweler in Switzerland that you should send this to, and for about $5,000, could clean it up, repair it, and it would double in value. So what do you do with that bit of jewellery after that person goes? I'll tell you what I think I would do. That night I would sleep with it. Not because of particular affection I have for it, but because I just would hate it to be stolen that night. To have what you thought was a piece of junk, you just discover it's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. To have it nicked that night would just about kill you. If it had been nicked the night before, you wouldn't have cared. And suddenly you're happy to spend thousands of dollars to take a big loan to get it repaired. What's changed about the jewellery? Well, nothing. It's just that you now realise what you had in your drawer. You now realise its value. You now realise the difference it could make to your life. And so everything about... So it's the question of worship. You now have begun to see the worth of this thing. And you were simply wrong in the past. And you're glad you didn't chuck it out in some sort of, you know, I've got to clean this place up binge. And so that's what worship is, where you see the real value of something and therefore you treat it differently. You take it down to the bank, you put it in the strongbox, you get a safe. You'll do something to keep it safe. You'll spend money happily. You'll wear it on special occasions if you're a woman, or you'll find a woman worthy to give it to, or something like that. But it's worship. Or imagine someone comes up to you as you're walking down the street and it's a hot day and they say, I'll sell you this bottle of fresh glacial New Zealand water. Oh, good, I'm thirsty. How much? $30. I say, $30, you idiot. How am I going to spend $30? It's not worth $30. It might be worth $2 or $3. $30 is a lot of money. And then someone comes along beside you and says, hey, see that BMW there, brand new, just drove it off the shoproom floor? Yep. I'll sell it to you. How much for? $30. Right. Then you give the $30 away easily. See, $30 isn't $30. It all depends on what you're comparing it to. And so often when people hear what they think God is asking of them, and they think, oh, that's way, way too much. That's $30 for a glass of water. But actually, if you can see the worship of God, you'll realize it's a BMW or perhaps even a Ford for $30. So this is the meaning of, this is what we're talking about. And the question is, where should we worship? So that's for the what of the worship. She asked the question, where? On this mountain or that mountain? Now, you'll know enough about history and human people to know that when it comes to religion, place matters. You know, if you've got Islamic friends, to know where Mecca is matters. You must know, if a person's a serious Muslim, even about when they go to the bathroom, they need to know where Mecca is so they'll know what direction to face when they're using the bathroom. It matters. We need to have a compass so we can work out which direction to pray to. That's probably the most obvious to us. There's a place that's special, and you need to go there at least once in your life for special rituals that you do that will help remove various parts of your sin. For devout religious Jews, it will be the trip to Jerusalem. Ironically, for Australians, it's a trip to Gallipoli, which I tried to explain to a Turkish guy once. It just made no sense to him at all. But I did say, Muslims go to Mecca, Jews go to Jerusalem, Australians go to Gallipoli. That's our sacred place. But Jesus says, look, it's interesting what Jesus says to her, and I think we often misunderstand what he says. She says, which mountain? And there's a case can be made for either. 21. Woman, believe me, an hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. Now what Jesus is not saying is, you can worship anywhere, you don't need to go to church. What he's saying is, lady, this whole question about where is about to be blown out of the water. This whole question, which is a legitimate question to ask, is like sort of squabbling about what table you're going to have on, what is it, April the 5th on the Titanic. It's not really a live and ongoing issue. An hour is coming when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. So he's saying, really, it's not about place. He said, in fact, we are on the verge of something happening that will blow that whole question of temples and sacrifice and holy places and pilgrimages out of the water forever. And whenever Jesus, and you probably know this, whenever Jesus speaks in John's Gospel about my hour or an hour is coming, he's always speaking about the death and resurrection. That is the thing that is about to happen that will completely change everything. There is no need for a place for sacrifice because all that has been finished and done by him. Let's move on to the obvious question of the who of worship. Jesus is a bit stinging here. He says in verse 22, you worship what you do not know. We worship what we know. Our salvation is from the Jews. An hour is coming and now is when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. Such people the Father seeks to be his worshippers. Jesus goes on to say simply this, in a sense the obvious. It's not about places, sacred places at all, although intrinsically in the heart of humans, We have this attachment to place, which is not necessarily sinful, it's just not ultimately that important. He said, it's about who. And he says this quite rude thing to the lady. He said, you Samaritans worship what you don't know. you actually don't know what God is like. You do offer worship, but your picture of what that God is like is simply not true. It's not unlike what the Apostle Paul says when he arrives in Athens, in the middle of this gorgeous city, full of the most magnificent and beautiful temples, filled with so many lovely statues. And he says, you know, what you worship in ignorance, I will now make known to you. It seems to be the view of Jesus that lots of what happens in worship, obviously religious sort of cultic activities, are actually done to an unknown. Ignorance is the problem. Where Jesus says salvation and truth and life come through the rest of the Old Testament, which the Samaritans didn't read. If you want to read the history of the Samaritans, in 2 Kings 17, it tells you about how that a whole lot of the Jews were taken away and a whole lot of foreign people were moved in. And the foreign people didn't know how to worship the god of the area, and the lions were eating them. So that the king of Assyria sent back some priests to teach them a bit about Judaism, but they also brought back a whole lot of other gods. So you had this mishmash of the worship of the true God with four or five other gods that were clearly false. And Jesus says, you don't know what you're talking about, sadly. Your worship is in vain because you worship what you don't know. And he says, he alludes to who God is by calling him the Father. This is, as you know, the distinctive Jesus title for God, that God is to be related to as our Father. This comes, it's an invitation to be able to relate to God and worship God as Jesus himself alone could, and he extends that to others. So he says, actually, it's about who you worship, not where. Number four there, the how to worship. Rather than ignorance, Jesus points to this. Verse 23, an hour is coming and now is when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. God is spirit, verse 24, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. You'll notice that there's a must there. There's been four or five musts in John's gospel. This is one. True worship. That which will actually, to step back again, that which will help us be healthy. Because in the end, humans, we will worship something, as David Foster Wallace says, but it will often kill us. It will often disappoint us and damage us. And so true worship is the worship that will actually bring life and wholeness, because human beings are unable not to worship something. So he says here, the worship is to be in spirit and truth. It's got one preposition for the two key words. So it's like the two sides of the one coin. You can't sort of do, you know, I'll have the main course and not the dessert. You know, I'll have the sweet and sour pork but not the fried rice. These two things go together, spirit and truth. The truth part seems fairly straightforward, doesn't it? Pontius Pilate says, what is truth? Jesus says, I am the truth. So it really is saying, if you want to worship, in fact, part of how you worship God is by listening to him. You show that you think God is not worth all that much if you don't bother to listen. Jesus says that he is the truth. He says, if you love the Father, you'll listen to me. You'll hear my words. So if you're going to worship God and know sort of the central human experience, you'll need to listen to Jesus. And it's to be done in truth. Now, frankly, in spirit, frankly, you can sometimes see if I'm in trouble understanding something because I put up a face on Facebook hoping to get some insight. Well, this will surprise those of you who don't like Facebook. I put up a request for insight about the spirit part here and got no light. I know many of you think that Facebook is full of educative, helpful things. Once every decade you get some quite useful stuff, but I didn't get much help there. What does Jesus mean when he says spirit and truth? Because he says God is spirit. So presumably there's a relationship between that God is spirit and we're to worship God in spirit and truth to know who we're worshipping. When it says God is spirit, it's one of the three great God is statements in the Bible. God is love, God is light, God is spirit. I take it when Jesus says God is spirit, it means the obvious thing, God is spirit, not physical, which is a common enough contrast in the Bible, between flesh and spirit. But I think what it's saying here is God is this, he is spirit, he's not in any way located or my energies are all tied up with this physicality. But God is not like that. He is able to be, therefore, everywhere because he's spirit. He's unlimited by the physicality. But I think it's also speaking of the dynamism, the energy of God. And I'm thinking here of the great theological treatise, The Life of Brian, where I think it's Pontius Pilate, describes this guy. He said, I like to hear spirit, daring do, and a few other things. And that use of the word spirit, it's that idea of, it's the idea of energy and dynamism and reality. And I think it's saying that God is that. God is spirit. He's not in any way located and centralized and limited by, as we are, by our physicality. But it's speaking of the sheer life-givingness, the energy that is God. And I think what it says when it's saying we must worship in spirit and truth, it's saying it must be according to the truth. I was discussing with a friend of mine the other day about worship, what they find helpful in worship. And I said, well, we've got to ask what God thinks. What is God asking for in worship before we talk about what moves my heart? Because those things may overlap or they may not. But the spirit part, I think, is saying that we must worship God with our real inner being. It's not just a question of moving the body around or saying the right words. It's a depth and energy thing. It is probably also related to the Spirit of God himself, who comes and enables us to worship, that he works within us. So Jesus is saying, I take it, that the worship must be not just in form, not just in manner, but a real life energy about it, like a heart thing. So it's truth and spirit. And then the last thing before we have some time for questions is the why of worship. I take it we worship frenzy because we have no choice. It's the same reason why we drink water. You're created by God as a dependent being. You are dependent on air, water, love, friendship, medical advice, all sorts of advice. It's an illusion that we're independent. And as all sorts of people have said, you will worship something. The question is, will you worship that which you're designed to worship? Will you find something worth worshiping? In the end, you see it, I think, with a heroin addict. If you had friends, or even an alcohol addict. But if you see an addict, they worship that thing. They must have it. Their life is shaped by it. Their life is determined by it. Their relationships are shaped by it. They worship that thing. But it's clearly unworthy of a human to be addicted to something like that. To find that, what is the thing that is worthy of you? And the question that the Bible simply answers is God. God is worthy of your worship. He's not asking you to do anything weird. He's simply saying, open your eyes and see. I've got two eyes, and one of them is dodgy, and one of them is fantastic. I mean, they both look magnificent. But I noticed last year when I was driving that there was a slight smudge on the left-hand side of the windscreen when I was driving down to the country one time. And I just sort of instinctively, I don't know why, went like that, and then I went like that, and I noticed that this eye, I can barely... I can sort of see these guys, okay, but this side is... And there's something growing over the lens. It's a very simple operation they're going to do when I can fit it in. This eye is nearly perfect. And I think when it comes to God, many of us will know the time that we spent much of our life completely blind to God. The notion of loving God, the notion of giving our lives to God seemed immoral, absurd, stupid. We just didn't get it because we were blind. Then I think often God opens our eyes and we see things like this eye. You know, it's kind of... So we give God what we think he's worth, but it's kind of blurry. And we see people who've got both eyes like this, and we think, well, they're fanatics. Anyone who's keener about God, more devoted, more sacrificial, they're fanatics. I'm well balanced. And that's how we work out who the fanatics are. But the question is whether or not we've seen God well enough, seen God clearly enough. And the great thing with when you get to see God, and when we say, oh, that's... I will happily give my $30 for the BMW. Will not happily give my $30 for the glass of water. And when it comes to God, it's like that. So when you hear of the sacrifices that clearly Jesus asks of his people, it's a question of whether or not you're worshipping the true God, whether or not you've seen this God. And therefore, you'll happily bow. You'll happily commit yourself to him. And the worship of the true God, unlike the worship of evil gods, false gods, you worship the wrong God, and it will distort you as a human. You worship money, you worship false gods. In the end, it will make you more violent, more selfish, more ruthless over time, bit by bit by bit. Worship the God and Father of Jesus Christ, the one who dies for you, the one who loves you like that. And it will sweeten your life. It will make you a kinder, more loving, more gentle, more generous, more straightforward person, bit by bit by bit. There's a great man called William Temple. He was, and I learned this from Gray, I didn't realize when he served, he was the Archbishop of Canterbury during the Second World War, and I think he died during, didn't he, isn't that right? He died partly from his exertions. Was a great man, but he says this about worship, and this is what the worship of God is like, the worship of the true God. Worship is the submission of our whole nature to God, the Archbishop says. It is the quickening of the conscience by his holiness. It is the nourishment of our minds with his truth. It is the purifying of our imagination by his beauty. It is the opening of our hearts by his love. It is the surrender of the will to his purpose. And all this is gathered up in adoration, the most selfless emotion of which our nature is capable, and therefore the chief remedy for all of our self-centeredness. So today it's worth pondering whether or not you have a God that is like that. A God who you instinctively happily worship. A God who is love, a God who is truth, a God who to worship just means you want to worship more, that you think, I can kind of see God and I like what I see, but I'd like to see more clearly. So we'll leave it there so there's some time for some questions. In no particular order. If God is spirit, how does this relate to us being made in the image of God? When the Bible makes that extraordinary statement that it makes two or three times, that we are in the image of God, because the Bible spends an enormous amount of time saying God is not like us. The word holiness basically means not like us and not like anything else. Genesis 1, I think, and 2 gives us a sense of what that means. But I think probably in a more philosophic sense, yes, I guess the fact that God is spirit and we are clearly spoken of as having spirit may well be part of the way in which we're similar. I understood, but how do people find true time to worship? Oh, you always find time to worship. How you spend your time shows what you worship. So if you say, I don't have time to worship God, you might actually be saying, I don't actually worship God all that much. I worship my profession. I worship my golf. I worship my... I think it's fair to say you always have time for the things that you believe is really important. So look at how you spend your time and look at how you spend your money, and you'll probably be able to work out what your God is. There are seasons where you might not have time to read the Bible, to meditate on the Word of God, which I think is one of the great secrets. If you want your eyes to go from like my left eye to my right eye, I think the Bible's great clue is meditation, which has nothing to do with the present excitement there is in our culture with mindfulness and emptying your mind, as my friends go to various Buddhist ashrams, etc. It's the opposite. It's actually filling your mind with the truth of God. It's mumbling over to yourself the truths of God so that you get to see. It's like it's by meditating on the jewelry that you begin to see the jewelry and you begin to appreciate what's there. But I don't mean to be difficult, but I think we always have time to worship those gods that we think are important. What about the when of worship? I think the basic view that the New Testament has is that all of life now is worship. You don't particularly go anywhere to worship. So it was one of the great discoveries of the Bible when people began to read it at face value in the 16th century to work out that the, and to quote Luther, who was quite good on this, that the preacher glorifies the God in his pulpit as the cowgirl glorifies God when she milks the cow. You worship God in how you do everything. I got savaged, very mildly savaged on the weekend by someone who's a very fine Christian in some way, and I thought, they don't realise that how you treat your neighbour is how you treat God. That at the point that all of life shows what you think of God. How you work, how you treat your neighbour, how you keep your promises, all that is worship. So if you've got a promise to keep that you don't want to keep, life would be better for you if you didn't. You will show what you worship by whether or not you keep the promise or not. If you worship the God of truth, you'll keep your promise. If you worship yourself and your wealth and an easy life, you'll break your promise. because we do in the end obey our God. So I think we worship God at all times. We go to church, or you go for a two-day weekend away, or you go for a quiet retreat somewhere to read the Bible and pray. We can have intensive times away. It's a little bit like if you are married, you hopefully love your partner all the time, but you may go away for a weekend away together, you know, to sort of rekindle the fires or whatever it is, to reassure the person that you do have time for them and to love them. And church can be like that, where we join together. So instead of drawing near to God on our own, we do it as his family, as his kids. That's the father likes to see his family together. I was with two of my daughters yesterday. We went out to see their grandmother, my mother, and they had a little squabble, which is surprising. Daughters having a squabble. But the nice thing was, about an hour later, one of them apologized and they had a big hug and they walked around and it was kind of nice. And there are a few things parents like more than seeing their family together and behaving nicely, and I think it's exactly the same with God our Father. What physical items assist you in your worship, Ian? Does music or art assist you? Well, unaccustomed as I am to ever revealing anything about myself, I, in terms of physical things, I think I find being one of the things I like about a little house in Monash in Canberra. You look out the window and there's some mountains, for crying out loud, and apparently in the winter there's going to be snow on some of them, which apparently looks good but makes the place freezing. But I find nature very helpful, just to remind me of the size of God, because no matter how big my sense of how God is, it's a tiny one. When we see God, we think, really? Why on earth did I ever worry about anything? Like when we see God's love, we'll think, oh, okay, I thought I had a bit of a grip on how much he loved me. No. So I think, there have been times when I found particular works of art helpful, particularly, there was a time I used to go walking and I'd drop into a little Jesuit church down at somewhere in North Sydney, and it had hanging from the roof a crucifix. Now, I don't like crucifixes, frankly. I've got all sorts of problems with how I think they can embed in our mind a particular moment in Jesus' life. But I found for a time that helpful, to remember that the God I'm speaking to is the God with wounds, the God who has died for me. I don't use much music, but I know people who I know and respect a lot will often listen to some Christian hymns while they're praying or reading the Bible. Hope that's of some help. Is collection a form of worship? Absolutely. When I give money to people, that's an act of worship, because I'm saying, God, I want to honour you with my money. And if I've got money, if God has given me lots of money and there are lots of needs around me, why on earth would God have given me the money except to pass it on to those who need it much more than I do? So when I give, I'm actually being like God, and I'm doing things that God likes. So I think, yes, money, the collection in church, although, as you know, most churches now, most of the money is being done electronically. But the collection in church is a great moment of worship in the church, or it can be. Living in the city, we're surrounded by the works of man, big buildings, BMWs, restaurants. Do we need to retreat to the wilderness areas to be more in touch with God? I think you've got to work out what helps you, but it may well be sometimes that it is true. Atheism historically has never been a big movement, but it has only ever flourished in cities where you can forget God and you can think we are masters of our destiny when you're clearly not. So I think for many people to get out and see is worth doing. It's whatever it is that will refresh, remind you of who God is. I think what you see in the city, it's like when I look at golf courses. Man and God together do beautiful work. I mean, the Opera House, the Harbour Bridge, it's like Adam and Eve working with God in the garden. That's a beautiful thing. But I think, yes, to get out can be very helpful. David Foster Wallace writes of the human tendency to worship, but what is the best way to explain Jesus as the exception to the failures of human worship? Gee, I wish I could understand that. Let me just make a very brief comment on what I think the person might have been on about. I think what Jesus does in the area of worship is, firstly, he brings the truth so you can know what God is really like. If you love someone and you want to make them happy, one of the things that we need to do is to study them, to understand them, to know what they like. And the worship, things done in the worship of God, which grieve God's heart, are not acts of worship. So we need to be willing to let God reshape our picture of him and the picture of what he likes being done. And then, of course, the other thing that Jesus does is, our tendency once we get to see God is to be like Peter, who catches a glimpse of Jesus' power and says, Lord, depart from me, I'm a sinful man. And what Jesus does, that's going to blow away both Mount Gerizim and Mount, you know, and Jerusalem, Mount Zion, is what he does when he's crucified, when he deals with our sin. So God, we can hear God say, come on up, don't run away in shame. You need not fear me. You can come confidently. So I think Jesus deals with the question of truth and the question of, am I okay? Ian, what does the worship of God look like day by day? How is this related to church? We've touched on that. One of the key verses about worship in the New Testament is that we offer our bodies to God as a living sacrifice. That Jesus has done with human sacrifice. It's the last great sacrifice. And we offer to God our whole being as our act of worship.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.